to a series of podcasts brought to you by the Yale Law School. Alicia Munell, Peter F. Drucker, Professor of Management Sciences at the Carroll School of Management at Boston College, discusses how employers have removed themselves from the retirement income game and how this affects government policies while putting more older Americans at risk. This lecture is part one of a two-part annual STORS lecture series at Yale Law School.
Well, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here. I'm not sure I'm an academic, and I'm sure not that this is not a question of law. But it's my pleasure. Also, that quote, it does mean that reporters literally quote what you say. It didn't seem to sound as pithy coming out as it did going in. So, as Harold said, my topic for these two lectures is that the number of players in the retirement income game have really gone from 3 to 2. So you used to have government individuals and employers, and now I think essentially you have government and individuals. And that is occurring just as the retirement landscape is getting more treacherous. And that's what we're going to talk about today. And then the second lecture is going to discuss the impact of that withdrawal on the number of people who are going to be at risk of not being able to maintain their living standards in retirement, and also the implications for government in the wake of the withdrawal of employers from the game. So here you have them, the players. And what I'd like to do first is just go through the evolution of the role of each of these three players, starting with the individual. In the beginning, there was the individual, and the individual did not need government or business because essentially the individual lived on a farm or was a blacksmith and wasn't going to live very long in the first place, and to the extent that he lived long, he could keep up farming almost till the end of his life or nailing on those horseshoes almost to the end of his life. Also, what the nature of that environment allowed people to do was to accumulate assets as part of their work. So if you were a farmer, you also got to own your farm. If you were a blacksmith, you got to own whatever you do when you put horseshoes on. But around the end of the 19th century, we had a big increase in urbanization and industrialization. So this is the only way I can give talks these days. I have pictures. So it's like a full life cycle has gone around for me, and back to pictures. So what this shows is the percent of people living in non-farm areas went up a lot around the turn of the century, and the people working in non-farm businesses also went up. And this imposed a lot of problems on the individual, because one, you took the individual away from his community or family where he could find support in old age, and you also separated work from the accumulation of capital. And so what that meant is that people who wanted to have some money when they wanted to stop working actually had to save money over their lifetime for their period after they were employed. Now, we do have this life cycle model that says that people will save when they're young, and then they'll have this nice pile of capital, and they'll draw that down when they retire. But it requires, as this slide says, a lot of foresight, discipline, and skill. And I think it's been well demonstrated that we people have none of that. And basically, these circles come from a survey by a research institute in Washington, and they asked people, have you ever even figured out how much money you want to have in retirement? And 58% people said no. And then they had some information on how many assets people had, and very few, less than half had $100,000 or more. Now, this is sort of an informal survey. It's a little wacko, the survey, because you really feel like people are sort of, you know, stirring their stew at 6 o'clock and somebody calls them on a wall. So they get very offhandish.
So we don't know if that $100,000 included homes or...
Yes, I do. You ask me a question, I know everything. So it doesn't include homes and it doesn't include defined benefit plans.
So then, well, if you had those and you had $100,000, how bad is that?
Not too bad. But not everybody has those.
Can you repeat the questions, please? Do
these numbers include, one, the house, and two, defined benefit plans? And no, they don't. This is sort of just financial assets, but this would include 401k plans. And so, I mean, basically these are rough numbers, but we have, I'll talk about it either tomorrow, the more precise numbers on how many assets people have as they approach retirement, and they really don't have very much. So today people aren't doing that good a job, and the question is why. And you've got this nice confluence these days of psychologists and the people, behavioral finance people at Chicago and some people in the economics department at Harvard, all looking into why people don't do what they're supposed to do. I mean, one thing is people are myopic. We're all myopic. We're focused on what we're involved today. We're just very reluctant to take a long look out and think about what's going to happen tomorrow. And then fancier things, they have these hyperbolic discounters, which they mean if you've got a big discount rate in the short term, low discount rate thereafter. And so you basically don't save, but when you get to retirement, you go, damn, I wish I had saved more. And if anything is complex, that makes life even more difficult. And people just tend to procrastinate. This is one of my favorite slides. This has to do with jams, and jams as in strawberry. And these psychologists did a experiment in San Francisco, and it was on two sequential bright, sunny Saturdays. And it was one of these stores where you have an infinite supply of olive oil and an array of vinegars, you know, maybe 10 or 15 balsamic vinegars. Well, they also had a lot of jams. And basically, on the first sunny Saturday, they put out a table with 24 jams on it for people to taste. And they got rid of the ordinary jams like strawberry, and they got rid of weird ones like asparagus, and they just had 24 mainstream jams. The second Saturday, they did the same experiment, but they only put out a table with six jams. So the first Saturday, 60% of the people who came into the store went over to this table, and it must have been quite a sight, right, 24 jams, and looked at them. And if you got to the table, somebody gave you a coupon so that you could go buy a jam at a slight discount. Well, only 3% of the 60% of the people who came over to look at the jams actually bought the jam, which is roughly 2% of all the customers. When you got the jams down to only 6, you actually had fewer people over because it was less of a spectacle. But of those who came over, 30% bought. Because when there are only 6, you can figure out what you want. When there's 24, who can figure that out? This is just one study that has sort of documented that complex decisions really stymie people. They just sort of say, I can't do it, it's too much, I'll do it later. In fact, if you ask people why they don't save for retirement, a lot of people say, I meant to, but I just never got around to it. And this kind of complexity is one of the reasons. So since we can't do it on our own, we really like commitment mechanisms. And the most simple commitment mechanism is the Christmas Club. I mean, people just used to get together and say, let's each put in $10 a month so that we'll end up at retirement with some money to spend for presents. And then they get more sophisticated. And clearly, the employer-sponsored pension plan is one of the, obvious commitment mechanisms that encourage people to save. This chart is, I think, an interesting chart. So let me just tell you for a second what it is. It comes from the published savings data that's put out by the government, the National Income and Product Accounts savings rate. You read about it on the Wall Street Journal, they say it's about zero, or sometimes minus even. So, but in point of fact, that savings rate is made up of two bundles. One, the saving of people who are of working age, and the dis-saving of people who are retired. And that wouldn't matter that much in terms of looking at trends if those two ratios stay the same. But we're having more and more and more people retire as a share of the population, so that has a big impact on the savings rate. So what we did is we tried to separate the consumption and the income, because that's how they get at the savings rate, of workers from the consumption and income of retirees. And so that top line is the savings rate for the working age population. So in point of fact, that was the point of that study. And it is interesting. It's higher. You still see some downward trend, really, in the 90s. But that's when you had the big boom in the stock market, if you believe in the sort of the wealth effect that could have had an impact on savings. But then we did a second thing, and we said, let's take out from the savings rate all the savings that is done through pensions. And so that's that bottom line. And you know, there's a lot of error in these calculations. And so basically what you find is that once you take pensions out of savings, or savings through pensions out of saving by workers, you basically find that that's the only way they do it. The whole point of this, just so we don't get lost in the weeds, is we're talking about the players. The first player we're talking about is the individual. And what comes out of the discussion of the individual is that in this post-industrial urbanized world, they have to save on their own. They're ill-equipped to do it. And in point of fact, they don't do it unless they have some sort of mechanism that makes it automatic. John?
I want to make sure that I understand that bottom line excludes housing equity. The saving that
through paying down their mortgage.
Yes.
That's a balance sheet transaction, I think. I'm not sure. Not sure. I agree housing is really important.
It doesn't include the growth in equity over time.
No, that definitely.
The only thing it would possibly include is the payments on your mortgage.
Right. It might include, and I think it does include that. But the thing that the criticism that people put on this savings rate is that it doesn't have any appreciation in assets. And if you think that's what people are looking for in retirement, you know, the wealth, not just the accumulation, then this isn't a great savings rate. I'm not trying to say this is a great savings rate. All I'm trying to do here is just say that, one, when you look at it, you really should separate workers and retirees. And two, it's interesting if you take out the savings through pension plans. And I think it includes the payoff of the mortgage, but none of the appreciation of house prices. So you have these people coming out at the turn of the century, and the world has gone from one where they were kind of set for retirement to one where they really had to do stuff on their own to ensure that they had a secure retirement. And they were actually found themselves in a very precarious position. One, that they could not stay in the workforce as long as they had before. There's some scanty documentation on how little assets they have, and a lot of them lived with their children, which was clearly not the optimal thing. You can tell because as soon as they got some money, they didn't live with their children anymore. So you had this situation where you had the elderly as a distinct poor population. You had employers playing some role here, which I'll get to after I talk about the government, in the sense that they were some employer pension plans, but they really covered less than about 15% of the population. So you had the government coming in, first sort of broadening the participation in the union pension scheme, and then introducing Social Security and an array of other ways of supporting older people in retirement. So Social Security came in the 1930s. So you had this sort of old population, poor population already. Then you had a major depression, which increased the numbers of older people who could not find jobs. And we passed Social Security in 1935. And basically, it didn't do a whole lot, got through World War II, had the value of benefits eroded by inflation, got to the 1950s where we enacted some reform that restored the replacement rate, which is something we use a lot in the retirement game. Replacement rate is benefits as a percent of earnings before retirement. Restore the replacement rate to the original level, which was about 30% of pre-retirement earnings. And then you had some expansion of pensions that we'll talk about later during the 50s and 60s. But by the early 70s, it became clear that this role was going to fall to government. So in the early 70s, what you had was legislation in 72, the goal of which was to restore a replacement rate of about 40%, index those benefits so those replacement rates stayed constant over time, and index them automatically for inflation over time. There was a glitch, and things had to be fixed in 77, but that's basically the goal, and that's where we are today, despite 1983 legislation. And what these three circles show you is the percent of income from Social Security for households in the bottom third, the middle third, and the top third. I've taken earnings out of these diagrams because basically people have earnings in their 60s, but they don't in their 70s. So this is a better indication of the steady state. And this is really telling in the sense that it is such an important program. And as you can see, lower bottom tercile households get 86% of their income from Social Security. Middle gets 70%. And even the top gets well into to the 30s. So this program, which was enacted in the 30s, remains the most important program for supporting people in retirement. Now, government also provides some benefits for people in retirement through the Medicare program. This circle shows the total expenditure for those 65 and over, and you can see Medicare pays for about 45% of that. I just think that's interesting because I think people think that Medicare pays for more. You've got Part A, Part B, and Part D. Part of it we pay for payroll taxes over our lifetime. Part is financed by premiums and general revenues in retirement. So this is another way in which the government supports retirement saving or retirement income. The government also provides indirect support for retirement through tax expenditures. And with Michael over there, this is a little, these are numbers, tax expenditure numbers from the budget. These, I think, are okay in the sense that they are the present discounted value of taxes minus benefits are more than just an annual number. But the whole point here is just that they're big. People who, and compensation paid in the form of pensions is taxed at a much lower rate than compensation paid in the form of taxes. You don't have to pay any tax on the corporation gets it, or the employer gets a deduction, and no taxes have to be paid until retirement. These numbers are big compared to federal personal income tax numbers. They're big compared to payroll tax numbers. And the government also subsidizes housing by not including the income from housing in terms of imputed rent, but allowing us to take a deduction for the expenses of owning a house through the deductibility of mortgage interest and state and local taxes. This is not, and then of course the capital gains on housing is not taxed, first $250,000 and $500,000. So, but the only point there is that the government has direct support for you in retirement through Social Security and Medicare, and then indirect support through tax expenditures for employer-sponsored plans and for housing. And the government also protects retirement savings by regulating financial firms. Some countries have consolidated their regulation. We still have it sort of dispersed. The federal level, you have regulation of financial firms. We sort of split the baby on the banks, and then insurance companies at the state level. The government also sets the retirement age. And when Social Security was enacted, 65 was sort of the age, the common age for retirement in other countries, and it was also the common age for retirement in the United States. So the Social Security legislation essentially reflected the status quo. Then in the late 50s, the government decided to award benefits early to women, and the idea was that women were 3 years younger than their husbands, and it'd be nice for couples to retire together. And so women were allowed to take reduced benefits at age 62. Then in 1961, the decision was made to allow men also to take reduced benefits at age 62. Mainly 61 was a weak year, and there were a lot of unemployed older men around, and this seemed, you could argue that this was fair because treat people equally. But what we've done here is we have now created a system where 62 is the sort of normal retirement age, not the official retirement age, but the normal retirement age. Because I think this is, don't you find that interesting? That's the percent of people who claim benefits at each age. And you can see for women, 59% of women claim benefits at 62, and 54% of men claim benefits at 62. And basically, there's a high correlation between claiming and retiring. So what we've done is we've said to people that it's fine. Just stop working when you're 62, and we'll provide some benefits for you. So just finally, so the government, we've done individuals, we've done the government, and now we're going to turn to employers, because employers have played a really important role in the provision of retirement income. Did I skip? Yeah. Essentially, in the late 19th century, the employers, they realized that they had a large number of employees who are stable employees, in whom they had invested a lot of training, and to whom they wanted to delegate a lot of responsibility for running their portion of the operations well. So basically, you want to have a good relationship with these people, and you wanted them to stay. And the best way of doing that was to have a pension benefit that you got a nice benefit if you did a good job and stayed through. You didn't get much if you didn't stay. So basically, you had these defined benefit plans where benefits were based on final earnings or some kind of earnings and numbers of years of service. And they were provided as an annuity so that people had a stable income for the rest of their lives. And that's for white-collar workers. For blue-collar workers, there was a lot of competition for blue-collar workers. And for a while, it was just sort of bidding up the wage, and then that seemed sort of not as productive as before. And so providing insurance for disability, or in the case of the death of the breadwinner, and protection as people age became a desirable way of structuring the compensation package. And then also, increasingly, employers realize that they've got sort of an elderly crew manning their locomotives or manning their factories or manning their offices. And they also, who were not as productive as they once had been, so they also would like to get rid of some people. And the way to get rid of people while maintaining good relationships with other employees is to you can retire them, but it's also good to give them some income. So that was the role that defined benefit plans played, both as an incentive for people to stay and a way of getting people to leave once they had their productivity was on the decline. So what you see from this slide is that basically up until about really the 30s or the 40s, pension plans just covered a small fraction of the popular of the working age of wage and salary workers, basically about 15%. And then you see after World War II, this big growth in the percent of the workforce covered by pension plans. And that's really from three factors. One, these plans have become an integral part of the personnel systems for corporations, large corporations. And as large corporations grew, so did these things. The second thing is that the favorable tax treatment of private plans, which weren't that valuable when taxes were close to zero, became very valuable when taxes were high. And then third, unions got a lot of collective bargaining power in the 1950s, and they pushed this for their workers. And what you see is a huge increase in the percent of the workforce covered by private plans, employer-sponsored plans, between the late 50s and 60s. So that by the 60s, mid-60s, pension plans look like a well-entrenched phenomena. And these are primarily these defined benefit plans, which are wonderful if you have one, because you if you have one and you stay with your employer, so that you get your benefits based on your final earnings, and you're paid in the form of a life annuity, which means you don't have to worry about one lump sums, and it's just terrific. So basically in the 60s, pensions look there to employer-defined benefit pensions look there to stay. They weren't a panacea, however. They, as noted before, they covered only half the workforce. A lot of people left. You had long vesting, and so a lot of people left and ended up with very little in the way of benefits. People saw their benefits disappear when their company went bankrupt. Studebaker is the example. So government, after a lot of to-ing and fro-ing in 1974, passed ERISA, which instituted vesting requirements and funding requirements and fiduciary requirements, and instituted the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, whereby sponsors had to pay in premiums, and then their workers were insured should they go belly up. So there you have it. You have these pensions that look great, you know, cover a significant portion of the workforce. You have legislation that's supposed to make them bigger and stronger and better and happier than ever before. And just as everything seems orderly, you have real shocks to the economy. And basically what you have is you have globalization. You have a decline in these sort of pyramid type structures that is really good for manufacturing and less good for sort of high tech kinds of things or computer types of firms. And you have a huge change in the workforce. You've got in the 1980s, you've got women coming in, and you've got young people coming in, more highly educated people coming in, and they just didn't have the same tastes as the people who came before them. And what this confluence did is it undermined the importance of unions, which had been an important impetus. It undermined the financial stability of firms. And having a stable firm was sort of the premise for having these pension plans. And then it just undermined the demand for a pension that was a reward for life with a particular company. This particular chart, I just think this is so interesting, is this looks at male workers. And it uses just the current population survey. And it basically shows you the percent of male workers at each given age who are with the same employer that they were with when they were age 50. So you can see in that top line, that's 1983. And by age 65, 60% of the people who were retiring or were in the labor force at that point and about to retire had been with that same employer for the last 15 years. And the dotted line is 2004. And you can see that that has dropped to 40%. And at 60, the difference is even greater. So you've really got a fundamental change in how people go through their work lives. And with that, a fundamental change in how useful defined benefit plans are to both the employee and the employer. Then we also had a lot of shocks in steel and airlines. This Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation was supposed to work smoothly with a low premium and everything would be fine. In point of fact, everything wasn't fine, and a lot of firms had to turn over their liabilities to the Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation. And I had to cut off, though, to make this chart work, to make these look like big shocks, I had to cut off 2000 to 2004, because that top number there is 4. In 2004, the top number is 14, so that if I didn't do this, it'd be hard to persuade you that this looked really bad in the 80s. But it did look really bad. People were really upset. And so you have all this stuff going on, right? So you had a change in the labor force, change in their demand for pensions. You had a change in sort of structure of industries, which affected the employer demand for defined benefit pensions. And then you had these shocks, these poor industries that got really beaten up. And then, just as everything else was happening, the costs of defined benefit plans started to rise. And this first point is the inflation rate. The inflation rate has a huge impact on defined benefit pensions. Think about it. What you're doing is you're accumulating these assets while people are working, and then you're giving people nominal annuities. And there's nothing better from the perspective of the employer to have nice high inflation that erodes the value of those benefits over time. If you have very low inflation, it's like giving people a real annuity, and it's very expensive. So this decline in inflation raised the costs of these plans. We also had an increase in life expectancy. Since these are paid in annuities, if people live longer, the cost goes up. And you also had a big increase in the ratio of, or decline in the ratio of active workers to retirees. Now, if these were funded, fully funded plans, that wouldn't be such a big deal. But basically, the active workers is sort of the size of the company, and these aren't fully funded plans, and so these costs just became an increasing burden. You also had a lot of these plans invested in stocks, so you had high volatility as the stock market goes up and down, and these feeding through to earnings. So that you had a hit on the cost side just as you're having a hit on every other side. And then finally, this comes to the perfect storm, where you have the huge decline in interest rates that we've experienced, huge decline in the stock, which drives up liabilities, huge decline in the stock market, which drives down asset values. And you have these defined benefit plans that were basically on a contribution holiday throughout this entire period. Like, look, they're putting in sort of $30 billion a year, just tootling along, happy as clams. Suddenly you have this shock in the year 2000, and their contributions go up to 100. So up to that point, you'd had a gradual shift from defined benefit to defined contribution plans, namely 401k plans. Not so much that people actually shut down their defined benefit plan and opened up a defined contribution plan, but mainly that all new companies opened up a 401k. Nobody opened up a company and said, oh, let's put in a defined benefit plan. But then after this perfect storm, you had a new phenomenon. You had perfectly healthy companies, the IBMs, the Verizons of the world, shutting down their defined benefit plan, either to new workers or freezing the accruals for existing workers. And so that, in my view, is sort of like the death knell. And so what do you have as a result of all this? You have a big shift in the composition of pensions. So this takes all workers in each of 3 years, 83, 92, 2004, covered by a pension plan. So this is covered workers, and puts them in one of three buckets: a defined benefit plan only, a defined contribution plan only, or both. And as you can see, in 1983, 62% of people with pensions had a defined benefit plan only. And if you add together both, I can do this, that's 88%. So the vast majority of people had a defined benefit plan. You fast forward to 2004, defined benefit plan only is now 20%. And even if you put together with both, you're down to 34%. So there's just been a dramatic, dramatic change in the nature of pension coverage in the United States. And this shifts the responsibility and the risk from the employer to the employee. The employee has to decide whether or not to join the plan. The employee has to decide how much to put in the plan. The employee has to decide how to invest those contributions. The employee has to decide how to change those investments over time. The employee has to decide what to do when he moves from one job to another. Should he cash out or should he roll over his contributions? The employee has to decide what to do about company stock. Terrible issue. The employee has to decide, this is a big thing we'll talk about tomorrow, has to do what to, when they get $100,000 in retirement, their employer gives them $100,000 and says, see ya. And they have to figure out how to spread that amount over an uncertain lifetime. So this is a dramatic, dramatic change in the relationship between the employee and the employer. I do want to be careful, though, because there have been proposals to move these accounts away from the employer entirely. And I think having a defined contribution plan housed with the employer is much better than having it just floating and having sort of nobody giving you any idea of what you should be doing. And employers have also withdrawn from post-retirement health coverage. As you can see, the percent of large employers with offering retiree health benefits has dropped from 66 to 35% of the total. But that really understates it, because even those who offer benefits have reduced the value of those benefits. They require higher contribution toward premiums from the employer. They require more in the way of co-payments. And so, yes, it's gone down by about half, but it's even worse than that. Employers are basically getting out of the health benefit game. And this is unlike pensions, where you really can't take away accrued benefits. Your employer can say, you know, you can retire at 63. At 67, the employer can say, oh, we're not doing that anymore. We're going to make you pay half or something like that. So you can have these decisions, these changes made long after you've retired.
This lecture was recorded at the Yale Law School on March 5th, 2007.